Today's podcast sponsor is Ordinary Vegan CBD, made from hemp. According to an anxiety study published in the Permanente Journal, after only 1 month of taking CBD from hemp, anxiety scores decreased in 79% of the participants.
You're listening to the Ordinary Vegan Podcast, where we teach you everything you need to know about adopting a plant-based diet, full or part-time. Our goal is to empower you to live a long and healthy life. You can find today's show at ordinaryvegan.net or on iTunes. If you have any questions, please send an email to questions@ordinaryvegan.net.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the Ordinary Vegan Podcast number 99. If we haven't met, my name is Nancy Montori, and my number one goal in life is to help you achieve optimal health and wellness that is kind to the planet and kind to animals. I know I have been missing in action the last 8 weeks, but I made a decision that post-COVID-19 and losing so many loved ones this past year, that I was going to work less and enjoy life more this summer. And I am happy to say I have stuck to that commitment. But today I am back and I am excited to talk to Mark Bittman, who has been talking about food, veganism, food sustainability for over 25 years. And before, talking about food was cool. He even wrote a best-selling book on how to cook everything. So Mark definitely knows everything there is to know about food. But before we begin my discussion with Mark, I wanted to talk about keeping you safe this summer. As we all know, we should use sunscreen every day, but it's even more important during the summer when the days are longer and the sun is stronger. And I highly recommend sunblock. At any rate, it is important to apply sunblock every day, but choosing sunblock is important. Why? Because there is a chemical called benzene, B-E-N-Z-E-N-E, that is found in some sunblocks and after sun lotions. The products include sprays, gels, lotions, and creams. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, benzene is a known human carcinogen. And based on evidence from studies, long-term exposure to high levels of benzene has been linked to leukemia and other cancers of blood cells. Benzene has been detected in several brands and batches of sunscreens at concentrations above the permitted 2 ppm, that's parts per million. So, which sunscreens and after-sun products are contaminated with benzene? According to ConsumerLab.com, benzene was found in 43 out of 224 sunscreens and 8 out of 48 after-sun products. By the way, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration suggests that no level of benzene is safe. According to ConsumerLab.com, some of the Neutrogena sprays, and they have many, it's just a few of them, had the highest concentrations of benzenes, and Sunbum cool-down gel had a detection of 5 to 33 parts per million. Just before Memorial Day, an online pharmacy and lab, Valisure, announced that its testing had found benzene in batches of 78 widely available sunscreen and after-sun products. The company has petitioned the FDA to recall these products, which include batches once again from Neutrogena, Banana Boat, and other top brands. More than three-quarters of the products are sprays. I will put the link in this week's show notes. It's important to note that benzene is not an ingredient in the sunscreen, and the findings are a result of contamination somewhere in the manufacturing process. So you are not going to see it on the ingredient list. Both Johnson & Johnson, which is Neutrogena's parent company, and Banana Boat issued statements reiterating that benzene is not an ingredient in their products. The testing company, Valisure, is asking for a recall of the contaminated batches and requesting that the FDA better define limits for benzene contamination in drug and cosmetic products. It is important to note that not all sunscreen products contain benzene and that uncontaminated products are available, should continue to be used, and are important for protecting against potentially harmful solar radiation. So, how do we choose our sunscreen? All I can say is do your research. I will put a link to the Valisure study findings, and you can see which sunscreens have the most benzene. I will also put a link to the Environmental Working Group, who has a free guide to sunscreens. Just go to ewg.org/sunscreen. Just for the record, there are also other ways to be exposed to benzene. Like sunscreen, many companies use benzene to make other chemicals that are used in lubricants, dyes, detergents, drugs, and pesticides. You can also be exposed by indoor air, which comes from products such as paints, furniture, wax, glues, and detergents. And a major source of benzene exposure is tobacco smoke. Hope that helps everyone stay safe this summer, and after that, too. Now, let's welcome Mark Bittman. Mark Bittman is the author of more than 30 books, including the book I mentioned earlier, How to Cook Everything, and Animal Vegetable Junk. He wrote for the New York Times for more than 3 decades and became the country's first food-focused op-ed columnist for a major news publication. He has hosted 2 television series and has been featured in 2 others, including the Emmy-winning Years of Living Dangerously. Mr. Bittman is currently the Special Advisor on Food Policy at Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health. He is also the editor-in-chief of the Bittman Project and the host of his new podcast, Food with Mark Bittman. Mark also has a TED Talk with close to 5 million views called What's Wrong with What We Eat. Now, let's welcome Mark Bittman.
Hi, Mark, and congratulations on your new podcast, Food with Mark Bittman, where you explore all aspects of food, from what to have for dinner, how to raise healthy children, and how to make the perfect meringue. 2 big picture questions about climate change, sustainability, and global hunger. You also have talked to a bunch of celebrities like Ted Danson and cooks like Nigella Lawson, and you already have 11 podcasts under your belt. Already with 700 5-star ratings. So my first question is, hi, and how does it feel to be a podcaster?
Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
You know, really, I have been on so many podcasters and I have done so many interviews in my life because really I've been a journalist for like 40 years, 50 actually. It's not that different. It is kind of fun, I have to say, as someone who wrote newspaper articles forever, it is kind of fun to interview people and then not have to write the story. Just have someone edit the interview. So I love that part. It's good. It's really given me another excuse to talk with people I want to talk with and call it work.
So what inspired you to start podcasting? And like, do you have a goal? Are you hoping to accomplish something with your podcast on a bigger level?
This is true of our newsletter too, the Bittman Project. There is this sense that I, or we, if we want to talk about my little team, have this approach to food that's multidimensional that few other people have, that I'm very, having written 15,000 recipes and something like 20 cookbooks, I'm very fluent in the conversations of the kitchen. I'm a decent cook and I'm a good recipe writer and a pretty good judge of what tastes good. And And I've been doing that stuff since 1980. So there's really just this sense that I can cook and talk well about food and how to prepare it and buy it and so on. But that I'm one of the only people who can do that and talk about sustainability, talk about the issues around food policy, talk about food and climate change, food and labor, food and race. I mean, pretty much any way that food interacts with the other major issues of our time. So our feeling was, my feeling was, let's do some outreach that says we have a different approach to food than most people do. We can talk about cooking, yeah, but we can talk about every other aspect also. And that makes our publications, our podcasts unique.
How did you get started and so interested in the world of food? How many years have you been doing this?
Well, I started cooking when I was, I'm 70, 71 actually. I started cooking when I was, I started cooking seriously when I was 20. I was cooking a little bit before that. And I started writing about food when I was 30. So I've been writing about food for over 40 years. And what happened was I spent the 70s, that is the decade that I was in my 20s, trying to become a writer. And I really failed at just about everything. I failed to make money. I failed to sell articles. I failed to finish things. I failed to find something that really worked until I started writing about food. And then suddenly I was selling articles. I was really interested. People were interested in what I was doing. And that really began in early 1980, and it just accelerated. I just kept writing about, I wrote about other things too, but more and more I wrote about food. And it just, I started to write for more and more people at broader and broader publications and better known publications until I started writing for the Times and publications like that. And it really just kept growing and growing.
Well, speaking of age, when you were 57 years old, your doctor told you you had pre-diabetic and pre-heart disease symptoms, and he told you it was either medication or a lifestyle change. And that inspired you to go vegan-ish.
Vegan-ish, yeah.
Because I read your best-selling book, VB6, Eat Vegan Before Six. And I really liked VB6, even though I was fully vegan, because I felt it was a really good jumping off point to a vegan lifestyle and left room for not trying to be perfect. And I always say in this podcast, you don't have to be a perfect vegan. Just do the best you can. Can you give me an example of what you eat now? And do you still follow a plant-based lifestyle?
I mean, largely plant-based. And, you know, when I started doing VB6, which was 2007, I really started a little bit before that. But when I started doing that, you know, there weren't as many, first of all, there weren't as many vegans. But second of all, there weren't as many, I don't know what I'd call them, non-militant vegans. I mean, there were more people who felt like it was really a black and white question.
Right.
And the language has changed and the attitudes have changed. I like to think I was sort of a part of that. But, you know, there are more and more people who say what you're saying is that let's be vegan-ish. Let's eat more of a plant. I mean, the term plant-based didn't even exist 15 years ago. Let's eat more of a plant-forward or plant-based diet. But let's not start screaming at people if they eat some animal products now and then. So that's how I feel, obviously, and that is how I eat. I eat way less meat than I used to. I eat way fewer animal products than I used to. I hardly eat any dairy. I do eat a fair, you know, I eat a few eggs a week. I eat some fish and I eat some meat, but it's not as dominant in my diet as it used to be. And I eat, you know, way more vegetables. And if the refrigerator is not filled with vegetables, I make sure that it is soon. And there's a lot of beans on my shelf and a variety of whole grains. And, you know, I'm devoted to that kind of diet and I push that kind of diet. But again, I'm still really fluent in the language of cooking whatever people want to cook. I do strongly believe that if you cook for yourself, that's a huge step in moving towards a better diet than than relying on junk food, than relying on what's out there in the marketplace.
Yeah, I noticed that you have podcasts on like how to cook a chicken kebab, but you also encourage people not to eat meat, you know, so I'm sure it's a delicate balance for you too, right?
It's a bit of a delicate balance, but I don't know. No, it's not actually. I feel confident in, well.
Sorry, I didn't mean to stump you there.
It's fine. I'm happy to think for a second. It is a delicate balance because I think that probably 100 years from now, we're certainly not going to be eating industrially produced animals the way we are now. We're all going to be eating less meat. It's just, you know, the law of conservation of matter and energy just demands it. There's not enough resources in the world for everybody to eat the way Americans eat, and yet that's what people want. So there has to be some way of figuring this out. And it's not going to happen overnight, but it's going to happen long term. You know, there's a sort of morbid but funny old saying that is progress happens one funeral at a time. Oy. When I was growing up, there were no vegans. There were barely any vegetarians. No one even talked about this stuff. So, you know, as my generation fades into the background, we're going to have subsequent generations that where kids are raised as vegans, where kids are raised in households that are where plant-based eating is more common, and where the discussion around how are we treating animals, how are we raising animals, where that discussion becomes more common and continues. And as that happens, I think we're just going to see, for both reasons, for both the reasons of supply, that we can't produce that many animals, and reasons of demand, people will see that industrial production of animals is on the whole a bad thing. For both reasons, I think the consumption of animal products is going to steadily decline.
I hope so. Over the years, I think the most important subject you've addressed in the past and present is the complex journey of the food system before it reaches our digestive system and how it impacts our lives. So can we unpack that a bit and talk about the challenges and issues involved around food sustainability? Because when we walk the supermarket aisles and we're looking for our favorite foods, food sustainability isn't often at the forefront of our minds. And our decisions are based on taste, convenience, price. But even those who want to live a more planet-friendly lives. So how does the average person, you know, figure that out?
You know, you remind me that I keep meaning to grab a camera, or I guess a phone would do it, but grab and just walk the aisles of a supermarket so that we can, I can just sort of consciously know and consciously say, here's what we're confronted with when we decide to go shopping.
That's a because great idea.
It is a good idea. I keep having it and I keep failing to do it. But, you know, you think of the soda aisle, you think of the snack aisle. I mean, if you close your eyes, anyone who's listening, and think of what those aisles look like, the cookie aisle, the cracker aisle, the candy aisle, the ice cream section, the whole freezer case. If you think of each of these sections, you start to grasp the enormity of how much junk is sold in the average supermarket.
I know.
And it's phenomenal because you walk in and they want you to think you're in this land of bounty and good food. And that's when you walk into most supermarkets, you're walking into the produce department because, oh, it's green and yellow and orange and bright and fresh. And there's very little or much less packaging. There's still a lot of packaging and it's real food and so on. And that's the image the supermarket wants to send you. But then as you go further and further into the depths, you are just confronted with aisle after aisle after aisle of junk.
I know.
And of industrially raised animal products. And we don't think about it that much. We just say, oh, you know, it might be nice to have some. I haven't had Frosted Flakes in a while, or I have, you know,
Cocoa
we need
Puffs.
Some soda, or you know, I want some ice cream or some chips. I haven't had chip, whatever. It's just there. That's the stuff that's there. And that's the stuff that tempts you. And that's the stuff we are encouraged to buy. That's where the marketing dollars go. That's how we've been brought up. You know, we were brought up to think Tony the Tiger was our friend and McDonald's was the coolest place to get your parents to bring you to eat, and on and on and on. And this is where the marketing dollars of American food production go, is to convince us to buy the junk that's sold in supermarkets. So, you know, the average person, some people are more committed to eating well than others. Some have more time to cook, or they're better educated, or they have more money, or whatever. Some people obviously do eat better than others. But for the most part, the food that is pushed at us is junk food. And that's, you know, that's demonstrated by what I think is a reliable statistic, which says that 60% of all calories in the American diet today are in the form of ultra-processed food. And ultra-processed food basically means junk food. So that's what we're eating. That's what they're selling us. That's what's there. Sure, a more conscious and dedicated and committed person with money and time can eat better, but that's not everybody. And most people are opting for the junk because that's what's there. And it's not just supermarkets, obviously. It's drive-thrus and restaurants and so on.
Of course. You know, often I'll see someone who's having a hard time getting around and looks like they are suffering from a food-related disease. And I want to go up to them and say, you don't have to suffer anymore. You just have to change what you eat. But of course, I don't. But the point I'm making is that I believe it's not their fault. They just don't know. They have never been educated in the role of nutrition. And my question to you, in your opinion, how do we reach those people? I mean, 8 of the 10 states with the highest type 2 diabetes rates in the world, in the United States, are in the South. So how do we reach those people?
Well, I think education is important, of course. But I also think that if you say to someone, imagine in your mind what a good diet is, I think most people conjure up kind of the same visions. Less junk food, fewer animal products, more plant-based food. I think that message is out there. I think a lot of people choose to ignore it because food is one of the few solaces that they may have. I think others can't afford to buy better food. I think there's a lot of places where better food is not available. So education is part of it, but I think income and availability and access to good food are important also.
I agree. I read a study recently that kids were twice as likely to eat healthy food after watching cooking shows with healthy food. One network made a major shift to unhealthy cooking in competition shows. And one network airs more than 385 shows and does not offer one full plant-based show. I don't want to, you know, but what do you think of cooking shows that promote unhealthy food? Are they contributing to the problem?
I've never been a big fan of cooking shows because I don't think cooking should be a competition. It should be a cooperation. And it should be a cooperation to make the best food you can make. Not the worst food you can make. So, I don't know which networks you're talking about, but I guess it doesn't matter that much. I think you're right. Cooking shows, to the extent that they exist, should be promoting healthy cooking, but nobody's making them, so they're not going to.
Yeah, that is true. How about the link between nutrition and the food supply? Do we need to focus more on the production of nutrient-dense foods in order to optimize nutritional and health outcomes? I mean, what can we do?
In the long run, it is about the food supply. And, you know, I don't know that nutrient-dense is really the right term to be used. I guess, but, you know,
fruits and vegetables.
I think people who want you to eat more meat often use the term nutrient dense because meat actually is, you know, really nutrient dense, at least it is, you know, per calorie. But vegetables can be nutrient dense. Obviously, vegetables are nutrient dense also. So I think the term is, how do we get the food supply to be more real food and less junk food, and that will improve our nutritional intake for sure. But it's not you know, nutrient dense sounds like you're not getting enough protein or you're not getting
enough
vitamin D or whatever.
Right.
But people are getting those things, but they're also getting too much sugar, too much refined flour, too much hyper-processed food, too many chemicals, and so on.
Well, you've had a problem with the way the United States Department of Agriculture has operated by compromising our food supply and being puppets of agribusiness. And not to get political, but do you think that will But do you think that will finally change with this new administration? I mean, is that are those the people who need to do something about all this?
Well, they have some power. I think the new administration gives us a glimmer of hope, but I don't, you know, is it going to be black and white? No. Is it going to, we're going to reverse course? No. We're looking at 150 years. The USDA is 160 years old. 1862 was founded by Abraham Lincoln, and he called it the People's Department, but it was never really about people. It was about harnessing the economic power that came with being agriculturally super productive. And that's the story of surplus. That's the story of generating food that's not particularly food products that are not good for you. That's the story of supply that has just is just about making money. It's not about nurturing people, or nourishing people. So that USDA could play a part in changing all of that, but you know, at some point you have to change corporate culture. You have to change motivation for why things are grown and how things are grown, and we have to find a way to put people's needs before corporate needs. And I think that's an evolution. I think that's an incremental change. USDA is part of that. Local politics is part of that. National politics is part of that. What people want and what people understand is part of that. There's not a big, you know, there's not going to be like a big fork in the road where suddenly we go in the right direction. I think it's going to be very gradual change. And I think, in a way, the urgency of the climate crisis is what's really going to determine the imminent survival of the race or of the species. But if, you know, if we manage to hang in there for 50 or 100 more years and make gradual changes, I think we can find ourselves in a place where agriculture makes sense, energy supply makes sense, human relations, societal relations make sense. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, and it's certainly not going to happen because Joe Biden was elected president.
Yeah.
Much as, you know, you can edit this out or not as you like. You know, I support the Democratic administration. I would like to see a largely Democratic Congress. I think things are moving somewhat in the right direction. It gives me, as I said, a glimmer of hope, but it's not, you know, it's not, oh, things were going terribly and now they're going well. It's that they're going less terribly, I think.
We're in desperate times here, you know.
Yes,
planet.
Agree.
I mean, it's just something's got to happen. And, you know, can we talk about food waste for a second? Because it's estimated that 40% of food produced in the United States goes uneaten, while more than 35 million Americans live in households that go hungry. I mean, it's ridiculous. And I think just let's start with the consumer, you know. How can consumers waste less food?
Well, I think that by buying real food and by cooking real food, you're going to waste less food. I think a lot of food waste is lost off the truck, left in the field. Some of it is legitimate. I mean, you can't predict exactly how much of any crop to grow, and you can't harvest every last thing and so on. But I think the fact that food is turned into fast food, is turned into restaurant food, is turned into junk food, and it's turned into food that's really disposable is in a large way to blame for waste. I don't think that, you know, this is really about lettuce rotting in your refrigerator so much as it is in how things are packaged and how things are produced in the first place. And let me say this. Often in the discussion of food waste, we don't take into account what food is grown and produced in the first place. And obviously you and I were just talking about that. But, you know, if a third of the land of Iowa or maybe even two-thirds, if some large percentage of Iowa and other Corn Belt states are producing food crops and using them for ethanol and using them for industrial food for animals or for food for industrially produced animals, are using them for junk food, all of that fabulous soil and adequately watered land is being wasted by not producing food for people in the United States and elsewhere. So it really requires, in my opinion, it really requires just backing up, and looking at the really big picture, not in isolated parts of it, because the answer is almost always lies in how we farm and what we farm. And the more we look at that and say, how do we restore dignity to farming? How do we put people who want to farm good food on the land? How do we raise food in quantities that are appropriate to the population centers that are near them? What is it that, what food do we want to be raising and eating? Those are huge questions, but those are not like in the kitchen questions. Those are in the field questions. Those are agricultural questions. And that's really what's at the heart of our food system.
Right. Well, my last question is, in your TED Talk in 2007 called
A Long Time Ago, yeah,
What's Wrong with What We Eat, which has, I think, 5 million views, you mention that we kill 10 billion animals a year for food. And that number in 2021 is now more than 55 billion land and sea animals die annually to support the U.S. food supply, according to animalclock.org. Meat sales reached record highs in 2020, primarily because people were preparing more meals at home during the pandemic, with beef leading the way. Why do you think meat sales are surging despite the rise of plant-based options?
I mean, plant-based options, it's the million-dollar question in a way. Plant-based billion, I suppose. Plant-based options have always existed, and I don't think that the high-tech, highly processed, so-called meat alternatives of the last few years are really providing much of a change for people who want a cheeseburger or a taco or a this or a that. There's not a lot of difference between the fake meats of today and the real, so-called real meats of today. They're all environmentally damaging and they're all nutritionally bereft. So I think it goes back to some of the things we talked about earlier, education and a different way of looking at the supply chain.
Yeah, it's a little scary. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing all your knowledge about sustainability, and congratulations on your podcast. I will post links to your books, all your books, your podcasts, and your website in this week's show notes. And thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Nancy. It was a great conversation. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it, too, and I can't wait to listen to your podcast. Have a great day.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye. Thanks to Mark Bittman for joining us today and to all of you for listening. I will put links to all his books, his website, and podcast in this week's show notes. I so appreciate your kind emails, messages, and posts. I don't know what the future holds for me, but I do know that I want to continue to try to impact humanity with a compassionate diet. Today's sponsor, Ordinary Vegan's organically grown CBD made from hemp, can be found on my website, ordinaryvegan.net/shop. The reason I began creating my own brand of CBD is because I believe in the power of this natural, organically grown plant and want to provide our community with a safe, clean, and reliable brand. My goal is to help you live a long, healthy, pain-free, anxiety-free life. And CBD from hemp has a long history as a treatment for those suffering from many ailments. I hope my CBD can help you. If you have any questions about how CBD can help you or how much CBD to take,
don't hesitate to ask me at questions@ordinaryvegan.net. I am always here for you. Please follow me on Instagram @ordinaryvegan and Facebook @facebook.com/ordinaryvegan. Or if you get a minute, write a review, because every review helps spread the plant-based message. Thank you, guys. Till next time.
Thanks for joining our plant-based community today. Together, we can accomplish great things. Please subscribe so you don't miss any of Ordinary Vegan's recipes and plant-based tips. If you have any questions or feedback, email us at questions@ordinaryvegan.net. Until next time.